Turning your Bibles to 1 Samuel 18, you'll notice Goliath is no longer hovering over our shoulder. He's probably going to become target practice for bows and arrows later this week, or BB guns or something, just for fun, but we'll see what happens to him. I don't know that I'm going to try and risk throwing my spear at him, but I don't think my shoulders could take that anymore. So we're in 1 Samuel chapter 18. David is coming down from one of those mountaintop experiences. He has just been involved in a fantastical adventure where he watched God deliver him and the Israelites in a mighty way because David was willing to step forward in faith. And so, that's sort of the backdrop. We are right on the heels of this battle. They've chased the Philistines all the way back to Ekron and Gath. Now the Israelites have plundered the Philistine encampment. And as we said, this was a major battle in that it proved to the Philistines that Israel was now a nation that could stand on her own. Saul has solidified the Israelite power to the point that he can now repel a Philistine invasion, which is a big deal considering before Saul, the Israelites were under the Philistine dominion for 40 years and weren't even allowed to have weapons. They weren't allowed to have blacksmiths in their own country. They had to go down to the Philistines and pay them to sharpen their hoes and their plows and all those things. So this is a pretty big moment for Israel to be able to show that they can defend themselves in this way. So we pick up just the first three words of chapter 18 there, as soon as. So we know this is right after the battle. There's not a big intervening time here in what's going to happen in this chapter as we look at loyal friends and jealous enemies. David is coming off of this great victory, and we're going to see what happens here. It's going to be pretty good instruction for us in how we interpret events. Because how many of you have ever had events seemingly go sour on you? Just seemed like everything exploded in your face. Ever happen? A couple of nodding heads. Oh yeah, if you've lived long enough, like 2 years, you understand that. Not everything goes your way. Not everything goes the way you plan it. You say, I thought this was going to happen, but this happened. Unintended consequences. And sometimes we're tempted to look at those unintended consequences and say, oh goodness, that was a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. When Kim and I decided to make a transition from full-time ministry to seminary, I graduated Bible college with my bachelor's degree from Appalachian, and we went into full-time ministry in a couple of different churches, and then in the midst of that, I started to think, I think I need a little bit more training to handle some of the things that I had questions about. And so we decided to leave ministry and go back to seminary. It's a tough call. I loved being in ministry, hated to leave it, and ministry was going pretty well at the church we were at, but we talked it over, prayed about it, and said, we really think the Lord is moving us to do this. And everything exploded. I mean, not literally. I'm about to say literally, but metaphorically speaking, everything exploded. It took us over a year to sell our house. We were renting a house, and the rent was so extravagantly high, not because we were trying to find a fancy place, but that's all that was available. Lansdale, Pennsylvania, where I went to seminary, is, I think, the second highest place to rent or buy a home in the nation. We didn't know that at the time. We actually looked at Washington, D.C., because there's a good seminary there, and we said, we can't afford to live there. So we didn't go there. And we settled on Calvary Baptist Theological Seminary and said, I think this is where the Lord wants us to go. And we started to go there and couldn't. I mean, just couldn't. So we try to sell our house. It doesn't sell. So we wind up renting a trailer south of Harrisburg, which if you can picture Pennsylvania, over here's Pittsburgh where we were pastoring. Right in the middle is Harrisburg. And we were living in a trailer south of there. And then all the way over here on the eastern side is Philadelphia where the seminary was. There's 100 miles from Philadelphia to Harrisburg, and that's what I was commuting one way every day for work. So I left the ministry, moved my family halfway to where we wanted to go, and then took me 2.5 hours every day to drive to work and then to drive home. So I would leave at 6:30 in the morning, drive 2 to 2.5 hours to get to my contracting job. I also calculated one day that it took me 2 hours a day I had to work just to pay for the commute, to pay for tolls and gas. So I'm really only banking 6 hours a day out of my 8-hour work day. Okay? So this is going, and this was not a high-paying job, trust me. Okay, painting contractors don't get paid a ton of money, especially when they're not the owner of the contracting company. So here I am, we're in this situation, and everything looks like it's going badly. Finally, we're counting off the months till school starts. We started this little expedition in June, and in July and August, there's no housing available, can't find anything, and school starts in 3 weeks, and then still can't find anything, and school starts in 2 weeks, and still can't find anything, and school starts in 1 week. And finally, 4 days before school starts, a house opens up, but it's 4 times what I was paying to own my house back in Pittsburgh. Now, mind you, we still haven't sold my house back in Pittsburgh. So now we're paying mortgage and taxes and all the utilities and stuff and upkeep on this house that we own in Pittsburgh, and we're paying 4 times the rent for this place in Lansdale. And I'm starting to accumulate seminary bills. So that's going on. Timothy broke his leg, 9 months old, and he's in a cast from his waist down. So they try changing babies' diapers when they're in a full cast. It's kind of tough. The financial troubles. I mean, just all these things. And we went to the orientation of all the students. It was about 2 months into the school year, and we had this big picnic, and it was lots of fun, good food, talking to people. But then people started standing up and giving their testimony, and I'm telling you, it was one student after another standing up and saying, you know, the Lord, we felt the God's call on us to come to seminary and get some further training for ministry, and my uncle came to me and said, I want to help you, I'm going to pay your whole way, and just praise the Lord for it. And the next person stands up, oh, I had a rich relative that passed away and left me a $20,000 inheritance, and we're using that to pay for this seminary, or, you know, I've had this and this happen. Oh, the house opened up right away, and we were able to sell our home, and we bought a house here, and we're able to use the extra money to pay for seminary. And Kim and I are just sitting there thinking, I wish all you people would shut up. This is really getting discouraging. Because apparently God doesn't want us to do this, right? Wrong. There came a point after the end of the first semester that Kim and I were probably about 2 days away from packing our bags and going home. No job or anything, just we still owned the house, nobody bought it yet. We were coming to the point of saying, this just isn't working, we're out of money. Everything's exploded around us, and this just must be the Lord's way of telling us this is not where we're supposed to be. And then our seminary president preached a message similar to what we're going to hear tonight. But he was basing it on a different text where Jesus sent the disciples out in the boat into the midst of the storm. And the main point that he made was they were right where Jesus wanted them to be in the middle of that storm. Now, how many of us would look at circumstances like that, where life seems to be collapsing around you, where everything seems to be going wrong, you feel like you wanted to pursue God's will and you stepped into God's will and everything blew up, and now you're thinking, ah, this just must not be the right thing. I must have misunderstood, or God doesn't want me to go this way, and he's trying to close doors. Sometimes God calls you right to the middle of the storm because that's where he wants you. That's what we're going to look at tonight. David's coming off this mountaintop. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. This is great. So he's just defeated Goliath. He's just been promoted to a place of national prominence. Everybody in Israel knows David's name now, which is going to come out in a little bit. He's famous. He's also now fairly wealthy because he's gotten this this reward from Saul. His father's house is now free from taxes in Israel. Wouldn't that be fun? No taxes? How many of you just love paying your taxes? I mean, it comes around to that time of the year, property tax. Oh, I'm so glad to donate my money to the United States government, because they use the money so well, don't they? Saw an op-ed in the New York Times today. This guy's calling for the removal of all nonprofit organization tax-exempt statuses. In the wake, and he's trying to connect it to this decision from the Supreme Court that now, since churches and things aren't going to be upholding the law of the land, so, you know, since we preach that homosexual marriage is not okay, that our tax-exempt status should be revoked. So, lots of fun. Got some interesting things to deal with, but anyway, David's doing great here, and not only is his name known in Israel, he's got this great victory, he's got some money, but now he's best buds with the crown prince, Jonathan, the one who, from all human standpoints, is next in line for the throne. Jonathan loves David, and his soul was knit to him. And Saul takes David into permanent occupation. Because up until this point, up until the battle with Goliath, David had gone back and forth. He split his time between his house in Bethlehem, taking care of dad's sheep, and ministering to Saul by playing music. But his time with Saul now is going to take on a completely different role, and it's going to become permanent. So Saul is drafting David into the standing army, as we're going to see here in just a few minutes. But notice what happens here in verses 3 and 4. If things were not going well enough for David, you could say, oh, this is even better. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Now, we need to understand some timing here. Because just as sometimes we get the picture that David was this wee boy, like Daniel's age. Not that you're, yeah, he's looking at me like, wee boy, what are you talking about? You're a strapping young man. Yeah. We get this picture of David, that he's a small child. How does that, not your small child. We'll just refer to a small child in general. And we'll take you completely out of the picture. How's that? Okay. That's not a good picture. David is almost a full-grown man. He's 17, 18 years old. So he's not a little kid. But we also get the picture that Jonathan is like 21, 22. And David is the 16, 17-year-old. But I want you to think here. Saul became king at about how old? Yeah, right around 40, we're guessing. Because when Saul becomes king, Jonathan's old enough to be in the army. Which means Jonathan's at least 20, which means Saul's got to be, you know, 30, early to mid-30s would be pushing it. Really pushing it. Wouldn't be unheard of, but it'd be pushing it. So we're guessing Saul, when he became king, is somewhere in the late 30s range. We are now 25 years later, maybe 30 years later. So Saul is pushing 70, which puts Jonathan at mid-40s. So Jonathan is not anywhere near David's age, and yet what's Jonathan's attitude towards David? He loves him. I think what happens here is that Jonathan is recognizing in David a man just like Jonathan. You remember the two times Jonathan stepped out in faith? He defeated the Philistine of the garrisons. Strike that. Reverse it. He defeated the garrison of the Philistines. And then later, when the Philistine army had amassed at Michmash, it was Jonathan that went over all by himself. Well, with his shield bearer. Kills 20 of them and sends the Philistines running. Jonathan's a man of great faith. He understands what God's able to accomplish through one man, and he just saw David do the same thing. So I think Jonathan is recognizing in David a man of great faith, and that's what's uniting them. But look what else Jonathan does here. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David. What robe would that have been? Probably something to do with royalty. Jonathan is the next in line. Jonathan's going to be king. If things would go the way they normally do, which we already know they're not going to. So we're not told what this covenant really entails, except it's probably a promise of mutual protection and friendship. And yet Jonathan, as a pact or as a token of this covenant, gives David a robe and his armor and his sword and his bow and his belt. Now, what would Jonathan, the crown prince, have been using all that weaponry for? What was the king's job in Israel? Defend his country. Jonathan's job as a commander in the army, defending the country. That's his place as the king, as the crown prince, to defend God's people. I think we see here in a very picturesque form Jonathan's handing over his role to David because he understands who David is. See, I think Jonathan heard with faithful ears what Samuel said to Saul. Saul still hasn't understood it. He still hasn't gotten it. Back in chapter 13, when Saul sacrificed the oxen at Gilgal without waiting for Samuel, Samuel said to him, "The Lord has taken this day the kingdom from you." Where'd it go? 13 and 14. Chapter 13, verses 13 and 14. "Now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." The Lord took the kingdom away from Saul, meaning that his dynasty would not last, meaning that Saul would be the last one to rule in Saul's family. Saul's not going to have a dynasty. And Jonathan heard that, and Jonathan understood that. Jonathan knows that he himself is not going to take the kingship. Saul doesn't believe it yet. We're going to see that in just a little bit. Saul still is holding on to hope that he can pass on this kingdom to his son. But Jonathan, I think, is a more faithful man than that, and he recognizes that he himself is never going to be king. And he sees in David the faithful man that God was looking for. And I think he recognizes, even though Saul and Jonathan probably have never heard about Samuel anointing David, Jonathan recognizes that this is God's man. And he makes this covenant with him and transfers all of those symbols of royalty, of the prestige in the robe and the position of rulership that's going to come with that robe, the position of defending God's people that comes with the armor and with the belt, and he hands them all to David, because I think Jonathan recognizes what's going on here. Very much like when John the Baptist recognizes that Jesus' popularity is growing, and his disciples come to him and say, "Master, Jesus is getting more popular than we are." And what was John's response to that? "It's okay. He must increase and I must decrease, because that's the man God chose. That's God's son." And Jonathan's able to say, "David, you're God's man. I'm going to follow you. I know you're going to be king, and I'm good with that, even though that was supposed to be my position." How many of us would let something like that go? Oh, our ambition gets in the way too much, doesn't it? We're jealous people. We'd like to have the riches and the prestige that would come from it. And yet to be able to sit and recognize and say, "Well, God is doing something through someone else, and I need to get on board with that and get good with it." Jonathan's able to do that. And so we see here David's having some very prosperous times coming after this battle. So, Saul has taken him into permanent residence, permanent occupation with the army. Jonathan has recognized David's place as the next king, and everything is going pretty good. Not only that, verse 5, "David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of all Saul's servants." This is a summary statement. It's interjected in the middle of this narrative to give us a description of how David's character is recognized by the people. Because everybody is seeing in David a man of good character, a man of faith, and a man of good organizational skills, good leadership skills. So he goes out, which is a term that means to go out to war. It's not like going out to eat or going out to Walmart or anything. This is going out to battle. David's going out, and he wins. Every time he goes out, he wins the battles. He's successful wherever Saul sent him, and so Saul sets him over the men of war. So during David's time with Saul, he's being promoted and promoted and promoted. Not only does Saul recognize his value as a leader, but everybody in the nation is seeing the same thing. This was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So David's gaining popularity not just with Saul, not just with Jonathan, but also with all the people of Israel. Now, why might that be important? Yeah, it's going to come in handy when he's king. Yeah, it's very hard to be king over a nation that doesn't like you. You have to have at least a few armed people on your side. Anybody ever heard Ben Franklin's definition of democracy? He said a democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for dinner. Freedom is a well-armed lamb contesting the decision. Well, David's life is going pretty well here. Verse 5, again, is a summary statement. It's interjected. Verse 6, we pick back up with the narrative. As they were coming home from what? The battle with Goliath. Okay, so they've plundered the Philistine army, and now they're on their way home. When David returned from striking down the Philistine, this gets David's attention. The women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. So every town they go into, there's a parade leading the way, because all the girls come out and they start dancing before the king and before the army. It's not a very long walk from where the battle took place back to where Saul had his residence in Gibeah. It's probably about 12 miles. So roughly the distance from here to Peru, not quite. They were about 14 miles down there. So not quite that far. So it wouldn't have taken them all that long to march back. So we're probably talking about the next day or a couple of days later. Probably they stayed in the vicinity of the battle for a little while to bury the dead and to plunder everything that was laying around. It's hard for us to imagine the scene, what a battle looks like when it's over, because we haven't seen one close to home in a very, very long time. But there would have been stuff strewn all over. So we're probably, maybe a week later. It's hard to say definitively how much time has gone by, but it's not very long after. And so David, as he's coming back with Saul to the royal palace at Gibeah, which really wasn't much of a royal palace at this point, but it's there. All the women are coming out, and they're dancing and they're singing songs. Now, here's where things get interesting, because look at the song they sing. The women sang to one another as they celebrated, "Saul has struck down his thousands." I have thought about trying to write some music for this, but it's not a very, it's not a very good congregational song, "Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Off the cuff, that's as best as I can do. "Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." So, all right, fellas, you're coming home from battle. All the girls are dancing around you. Do you want to be ascribed the thousands or the 10,000s? Not too hard to figure out, right? I want the 10,000s. That sounds better. That makes me out to be a bigger hero. Did David strike down 10,000 people? He got one, but he was a big guy. Yeah, he was big. So, as all these women are out, this scene catches somebody's attention. While everybody else in the country is just caught up in the celebration, there's one guy that notices what's being said and doesn't like it. Saul. Now, Tim, why might Saul not have liked that song? Because he's the thousands, right? As the king, why would that be bad to him? What's that, Patricia? Yeah, he's supposed to be better. You're the king. You're supposed to be the strongest guy in the country. You're supposed to be the smartest guy. And yet now you suddenly realize everybody in the country is singing a song that makes this other fella, who's your servant, and up to this point you really liked the guy, but this is not sitting well with Saul. He doesn't respond with the same faithful acceptance that his son did. Because look at how Jonathan accepted it. Jonathan just, right off the bat, says, "You're the next man. You're God's man to rule Israel. Here you go. I'll hand it over to you." And Saul hears that God is raising David in the ranks and in the estimation of the people, and he's getting angry about it. He recognizes that David's popularity rose to such a point that he perceives a problem. Verse 8, Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed only thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? He's got the popularity of the people. I've given him command of the army. What else can he do but take over? The people like him better than they like me. Verse 9 tells us how Saul responds to recognizing this. Instead of rejoicing that God was raising up the next king of Israel and seeing what God was accomplishing in and through David and rejoicing in that, Saul eyed David from that day on. Now, it's not stating here exactly what's going on, but what does it mean to eye somebody? You can picture the look on Saul's face as you're kind of squinting a little bit, tilt your head, stare at him. Every time David's not looking. Now, what are you doing when he's looking at you? Good job, David. Nice work. That David. From that day forward, Saul's opinion of David changes to one of suspicion. And everything David did from that point on is going to be interpreted by Saul in a suspicious way. He's going to look at everything David does as an attempt to gain his throne. So from this point onward, everything David does, Saul can't look at it in a good light. He can't say good job anymore, sincerely. He can't say well done. He can't rejoice in anything that David's going to do. Everything from this point on is going to be eyed with suspicion and mistrust. So this is where things are going to start taking a turn for the worse in David's life. So imagine you've just been hired on a new job. The pay is great. You're in a management position. And on top of that, everybody underneath of you loves you. Now, we tend to make fun of those in management. I realize that. Okay? Just kind of the thing you do around the water cooler, talk about the boss, right? But around the water cooler in the palace of Saul, the talk about David is all good. This guy's great. He's young, he's courageous, he's strong. He's a good-looking fellow. Don't think we haven't noticed that either. And God is with him in mighty ways. But, verse 10, the next day, David doesn't hardly get a breath before things start taking a negative turn. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul. It's talking about the intensity of this discouragement that God is sending to Saul, and it is because of Saul's faithless disobedience. We got to understand, when we get into those patterns of being elated and then coming down and hitting the bottom and being just discouraged all the time, so many times when you're counseling people in those situations, there's some kind of sin in their life that's unrepented of. And that's the case in Saul's life. He refuses to acknowledge what he's done wrong. Remember how he handled being challenged by Samuel? What did he do? Made excuses. Oh, it wasn't me, it was the people. They brought the sheep here. I did obey God. God told me to go kill all the people and all the animals. I did obey God. I killed everything except for those. He made excuses. He made exceptions for himself. Saul's not willing to recognize that God has rejected him from being king and has transferred the kingship to David. So in God's mind, this is already done. And even though David doesn't have the title and the throne yet, who are the people following? David. He's going out before them in the battle. They love him. They're obeying his commands, and Saul, holding himself up in his palace from this point forward, is just going to continue to go on this downward spiral from bad to worse. So that harmful spirit rushes upon Saul with a great intensity. He raved within his house while David was playing the lyre. He raved. Anybody ever rave? Ever been in a rave? It's not a fun place to be. To have yourself so out of control in your anger that you're screaming and yelling and throwing things. That's where Saul is at right now. He's raving within his house. And David is trying, as he had before, to calm Saul by playing some music on his guitar. All right, that's a modern interpretation, okay? A lyre is kind of like a guitar. They look a lot like him. So he sits down and he starts playing. And normally, up until this point, when David had done that, it had calmed Saul down. But what's Saul's response this time? Saul had a spear in his hand. And Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. All right, Jerry, in all your years working, any of your managers ever try to spear you to the wall? No, really? Huh. Dan, any of yours? Maybe verbally. Eldon, how about you? Yes, they tried to spear you to the wall, huh? You all heard it here. Eldon has admitted to having a reputation. Yeah. Occasionally you do get a manager that treats you underhanded that way. And I've had people yell and scream at me and call me all kinds of names. Never had anybody throw any spears at me or try to shoot me or anything. So David's having a bad day at work here. But God protects him. David evaded him twice. So Saul throws the spear once, he misses. You might think, oh, he'll calm down now, he'll realize what he did. But nope, he realizes what he did, he missed. So he's going to try again. He runs over, grabs the spear, and throws it at David a second time, and misses again. I'm amazed that David was still standing in the room for the second throw. I mean, you'd think you'd be out the door. But I also want you to notice the faithfulness of David in this scenario, because who is obviously the younger, stronger warrior? Who could have ended this fight pretty quickly? David, a 20-year-old or so, versus Saul, the 65 to 70-year-old. If it came down to it, probably David could have ended this fight pretty quickly, if he wanted to. But we're going to see this time and time again. David being such a man of character that he's not going to lift his hand against God's anointed king. David's a man of integrity. And Saul is a man of vacillations, ups and downs, back and forth. He's instable or unstable. Which is it? Instable or unstable? Unstable. He's unstable. Now, Saul's suspicion is going to change a little bit. In verse 12, Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him but had departed from Saul. The historian is writing for us some insight into what's going on here that we probably wouldn't get from any other historical work, but God can tell us what's going on in the heart of these people. And so he tells us plainly what's happening. Saul is afraid of David, and the reason Saul is afraid of David is because Saul recognizes that God is now working through David and not through Saul anymore. So Saul sees what is happening, and it scares him. But again, rather than repent and turn in faith to God, how's Saul going to handle this? He's going to throw spears. He's going to try and destroy that through which he recognizes God is working. We've seen Saul act with some faith in his life. But the sad tragedy is that he's a man who doesn't have enough faith to get his eyes off of himself and look at what God's doing. Instead of acknowledging the wrongs he's done, repenting of his sin, I really think would have cleared everything up for Saul. I honestly think he had repented of all his sin right there and turned to the Lord. This harmful spirit from God could have departed, and the transition to the nation, allowing David to take the kingdom, could have happened more smoothly for Saul. And yet, God is working through Saul as well, because he has some things David needs to learn. As I was mentioning about seminary, you know, I thought I needed to go to seminary for training, and very often, We'll get an idea in our heads and we'll recognize God moving us in a certain direction. But the reason we think we're going that direction is not the reason God's leading us that direction. Oh, we think God's leading us that direction because there's green pastures over there. And there are. We think we're going that direction because we're going to be able to help people or whatever reasons. But you know what I learned in the 5 years that it took me to get a one-year degree? It had almost nothing to do with the classes. You realize all the money that I spent on seminary training, and most of that stuff I already knew. As I sat through seminary class and saying, this is not new. Appalachian Bible College prepared me well for the theological tasks of ministry. And I appreciate the work that they did. Because half of the theology classes and things that I took in seminary wound up being repeats of what I'd already had. I said, God didn't bring me here for the schoolroom. But you know what we went through in those 5 years? Sometimes it's hard to relate. It was awful. It was a horrible time. Kim and I look back on that as one of the worst times in our lives. And yet, God grew us in ways through that time that we never would have experienced without enduring those difficulties. And so while we're glad to look back on the times and realize we're not there anymore, we also look back with a great deal of gratitude to say, look what God's accomplished. You don't always see that when you're in the middle of it. And I don't know if David, we're reading his Psalms on Wednesday nights and we see the anguish that he expresses in so many of those Psalms. The things that he learned in the time serving Saul, being chased, having spears hurled at him, being chased through the wilderness, being falsely accused, having his wife stolen away from him, all of those things God used to prepare David to be king because God had big purposes in mind for David. And he wasn't ready. Oh, God prepared him for great things leading the sheep in the wilderness around Bethlehem. But God has even bigger things prepared. And David needs to go through these difficult times. So very often when we get into those difficult times, we start thinking, oh, I must have made a mistake. We get so pragmatic about things, don't we? And we start to think, if it doesn't work, it was a mistake. And you cannot think that way about the Christian life. Oh, if you're designing a new product, or like if Gary's designing lawnmowers and the blade flies off across the room and embeds itself in the wall of his factory, he can say, I made a mistake. It didn't work. But in the Christian life, when everything blows up around you, that doesn't necessarily mean it was a mistake to go where you're at. It means God is growing you. God is leading you through hard things because you need to grow. You need to learn more about Him. And it's something you cannot learn when everything's comfortable. David could not learn how to be the king that he needed to be if everything had been like we read in the first half of this section. Jonathan loved him, Saul loved him, all the people loved him, he was successful everywhere he went. That wasn't going to teach David what he needed to know. Because what he needed to know was to trust God when nothing makes sense, when everything looks like it's falling apart. Are you still going to hang on to your faith in a sovereign God who loves you? Or are you going to give up and say, God hates me, He just wants to squash me? You're going to quit praying. You're going to quit seeking Him. You're going to quit obeying just because it got hard. Well, Saul's got a response to David's rise to prominence, and it's going to work in David's favor, just as God planned it. Saul removed him, that's David, from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. Now, why do you suppose Saul might have made David commander of a unit of military people? What's that? Yeah, I think Saul's kind of hoping David won't come back from one of these battles. See, because the general wouldn't go into the battle. Commander of 1,000's right at the front of his troops. If Saul had left David in command of the entire army, David would have been commanding from behind and issuing orders to different units, but Saul puts him in a place where he's going to be right in the front of the battle, where all the arrows are flying, where all the swords are clanging, and the spears are being thrown.